TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. This week on the show, we're joined by Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer. Also with us is staff writer Patrick Michaels. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by journalist, author, and former Observer Managing Editor Chris Tomlinson to discuss his book, Tomlinson Hill. The book chronicles the stories of two families who trace their roots back to a slave plantation that bears their name. But before we get to that, we've got a story to discuss out of the West Texas town of Alpine that has just about everything in it. Drug busts, border security, a tiny little smoke shop called the Purple Zone, irate parents, and what's at stake? Civil liberties. Patrick, this is just a little personal aside from me to you, but you have this knack for finding these very interesting stories in sort of remote locations. Is that fair? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, well, good. I'm wondering if you can tell us about Alpine and what kind of town it is.
Sure. Well, it's a great town, and it's, you know, I'd been out to Marfa before, and I'd driven around and driven through Alpine, but I'd never spent a lot of time. But, you know, where Marfa sort of has the reputation of, you know, as an artist commune, right, and, you know, much kind of smaller place, Alpine is more of a functional town with more of a blue-collar vibe and people who live there and work in, you know, proper jobs, as well as artists, big on murals and culture around town as well. But it was a bigger place. But in this case, there was a whole lot of the sort of small town intrigue that you'd see in, you know, East Texas small towns or anywhere else in the state.
Sure.
And so, I mean, it's a complicated story to get into, but there's sort of three pieces, that come together. And there's this federal overreach that a lot of folks in West Texas are pretty sensitive to, because you move out there trying to get away from being bothered.
Sure.
Generally. Right.
Right.
And then, in the last few years, of course, you know, the federal presence has increased all across the border, you know, trying to catch drugs and trying to curb illegal immigration. And so, you know, it's been happening a whole lot in the valley, obviously. You hear about that the most,
right,
but it's, you know, just like that in the Big Bend, you know, not too far from the border, same kind of issues. And you have ranchers who are tired of, you know, Border Patrol driving across their land.
Right. Tourists trying to go through.
Tourists, yeah. Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. So there's that, and there's the small town drama we were talking about of this sort of tempest in the teapot. And, mm-hmm, you know, folks who just kind of fight the same fight over and over again for years. And then there's the precipitating issue here is synthetic drugs. And that's a big issue generally, I think, across the country, the war on drugs. The DEA has turned that very sharply to synthetic drugs, and they see that as a few years ago, and it was a totally unregulated market, and so they're trying to crack down hard and make a big statement quickly to let people know that synthetic drugs are not okay.
Which there seems to be a slight disconnect here, which is if you're increasing border presence, trying to fight border drugs, but then focusing on synthetic drugs on this side of the border, I mean, that kind of... Can you explain why that's become a focus?
Sure. And I think that I should probably just explain what the story is here. There's the Purple Zone, which is a smoke shop that opened in 2007. And the owner she basically was running an antiques business, mm-hmm, in Alpine for years, and found that the market for antiques was not as great as the market for sex toys and, you know, this stuff at smoke shops, you know, that she has
that a little surprising.
Hookah lounge now for students to come hang out. And there are Bob Marley posters and, you know, wall hangings with sort of black light swirlies on them and that kind of thing. And it's sort of a place to hang out and not be at the bar. And that's,
right,
that's the thing that she loves about it. She says that it's not, you know, you don't have to go there and get drunk. You can, it's a place to hang out. And so, the problem, from local law enforcement's perspective, is that she had been selling some products, they say, and she wouldn't confirm this with me because her case is still open, but it's, mm-hmm, there in the court records. They've seized a whole bunch of things that under Texas law now, they're saying include chemicals that are banned. And these are things that are they're called synthetic cannabinoids, mm-hmm, and they're basically synthetic pot. And, you know, these chemicals get outlawed, and then the manufacturers kind of tweak them a little bit, and then, you know, technically are legal. The DA in this case is saying that, you know, he's somebody who would argue for sort of, you know, broadening, you know, whatever's being banned in the law to say that it applies to anything that's,
right,
that's similar to it. So there's been a fight since the first raid on the Purple Zone in March of 2012. There have been three others since then, and the last one was in May. It was a big federal raid with the DEA's involvement. And so it's just sort of escalated. And this whole time, she's been charged, she and her mother actually have both been charged for distributing drugs that are just as illegal, you know, in the law books as cocaine or heroin or anything else. I mean, they're right there. These are serious in the law. So they've been charged but not convicted of anything. But they've had this series of raids on her shop. And at this point, it sort of looks like every time they raid the place, they take stuff out, even that's not illegal to have. You know, in, to some sense, they're just kind of taking her merchandise out of her store.
Right.
You know, you don't get that stuff back when the DEA comes and you know, carts everything away and hauls it to a lab.
So why is she still there? I mean, it's four raids, right? I'd be pretty discouraged.
Yeah, and so part of the point that the DA is making is that she's had ample opportunity to leave. You know, they've given her warnings and said, you know, just close your shop or at least stop selling the spice is what, you know, the general term is, you know, these little incense packets. Stop selling this stuff and you know, you can go on your way. And she's saying, well, everything I've got is legal. She says she tests everything that she buys to be sure that it's legal to have. And so, you know, it's like any other business owner, you know, trying to do what you can to make a buck. And that's where a lot of the sort of the crusty folks who might not have gone to the Purple Zone to buy anything there, you know, live in West Texas, just don't want to be bothered.
Sure.
You know, look at this as a civil liberties issue. And they say, well, hey, if, you know, what she's selling is legal, you know, why are the cops coming in and busting down her door over and over again? One of the really interesting things here is that, you know, according to the cops, there were some things they found in her shop that were illegal, that are on Texas' list of banned substances. But that's under a law that took effect in the middle of 2013.
Right. The timing is a little off.
And everything that had been picked up in her shop was from before that. Three
right.
separate raids, all from before that law took effect. So the charges against her right now, the state charges, are all for, you know, for stuff that was picked up before it was illegal.
Right. It was essentially legal at that time.
Right. So it hasn't been worked out in court. You know, it may or may not ever go to trial, just because lots of cases don't. But that's one of the big issues here. The other thing is there was this federal raid in May. And that is what sort of precipitated the whole thing.
Right.
Becoming it was a national news story on First Amendment type of issues. If we could get into sort of what happened there.
Sure.
That's the other thing that makes this thing such a mess is it was the morning of May 7th, I believe, this year. And the DEA and the Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, the local PD and the local sheriff's office, there was this whole task force that showed up on the door, on the doorstep, broke the door down, hauled in a bunch of stuff. And they also went into the garage apartment behind the place. And there's a guy who lives there who sort of came back and found his place getting tossed.
Separate
by the feds.
Address, right?
So it's a separate address.
Right.
It's like, you know, something and a half.
Yeah.
It's right in the backyard, but he has a separate lease for it. And he's saying, hey guys, you don't have a warrant for my place. You know, what are you doing back there? So they get a warrant for his place as well. And they check it all out. And, you know, so there's two places now roped into this raid. The sister of the shop's owner ends up in a shouting match with one of the DEA agents, and she says that she was pushed down to the ground and held down there with the butt of his rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a red mark on her neck in a photo that she says proves it. And the DEA spokeswoman who I talked with said that didn't happen, that she kicked the DEA agent, and you know, she got scratched on the neck is what that red mark is from. So she has federal charges against her for assaulting an officer she's saying is the one who assaulted her. And at this point, it's sort of, you know, one person's word against the other, and there are witnesses on both sides of things. So it's a whole mess, and, you know, who knows who to believe. But it got really big news, became really big news, because the shop's owner was in prison on a federal weapons charge. They found some ammunition in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Because she has these state charges against her, she wasn't supposed to have any ammunition that she, I guess, wasn't supposed to be buying any ammunition.
Right.
She had that for her gun. So she's in jail, and they tell her that the conditions of her release, if she wants to bond out of jail before her trial, which is months away, she has to issue an apology for having spoken to the press and said, you know, what a sham this raid was, and saying that, her sister was assaulted. She has to say in writing that her sister was the one who assaulted the DEA agent. And she has to deny being basically chased out of town by folks who don't like her, which is what she told the press. So there are very specific things that she was told by the U.S. attorney she had to do to get out of prison, or out of jail. So she signs the letter and gets out. And at that point, it was national news, because there were First Amendment scholars who said there's right. no way you should have to sign this kind of admission just to get out of jail before your trial.
Right.
Long story.
It's very long, and there's so many moving parts. You know, so what's the situation now? What's the status now?
Well, the situation hasn't changed too much. You know, right around this summer was a deadline for the shop's owner to accept some pleas, first on the state charges and then on the federal ones. And I haven't heard what the latest is on that, if she's taken those in either of those plea deals. And if not, she has her trial for the state charges is coming up this fall, and I believe the federal charges come up a few months after that. So there could be a trial on this stuff in West Texas in a few months.
And what's the takeaway? I mean, you know, what kind of story is this, I guess, is the question, right? Because it seems it brings in so many different aspects, so many different ideas. I mean, as the person who wrote it and reported it, what's your takeaway from the whole situation?
Well, I guess the biggest thing for me is that you had an area that was pretty remote, and this might have stayed a small town story. But because the war on drugs has moved in so heavily to the Big Bend, and you have this increased federal presence there, this is the kind of thing that can happen. It's a lot easier for stuff to blow up like this and become. And this is a nationwide drug bust that was happening on that day. It was a nationwide operation against synthetic drugs, and it looks to me as though this shop in Alpine had been a target of the local authorities for a while. The feds who were in town saw this as another way to sort of just add one more place
right.
into their federal net. So it's a story about West Texas, you know, in an age when the federal government and DEA are moving in force, and the sort of things that you can look forward to. And then it's a story of small town drama, just you're running around and around for years and years and just getting nastier.
Well, the story is The Thin Purple Line. You can read it on TexasObserver.org. Patrick, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. For his first book, author and journalist Chris Tomlinson researches his own family's slave-owning history. The result is Tomlinson Hill, a book that examines two families, one white and one black, who trace their name back to a Central Texas slave plantation. Joining us by phone to talk with us about the book and his experiences writing it is the author himself, Chris Tomlinson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Happy to be here.
So, just to start out, can you give us a sense of the book for the people who have not read it yet?
So, the book follows these two families, both named Tomlinson, one black, one white, from the slave days to 2007. It begins when the first Tomlinson, a white woman, walked the hill and picked out a plot for her brother so he would move to Alabama with 48 slaves. And it ends with the last Tomlinson to live on the hill, who was a black man named Oliver Tomlinson, and he is the father of the famous running back, LaDainian Tomlinson, who recently retired from the San Diego Chargers.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, some of the knowledge that must form the germ of this book obviously goes back to your childhood, but when did you realize, was there an aha moment when you realized that there was a book here, or that you wanted to write a book about this information?
Well, I've known about the Black Tomlinson since I was 8 years old. My grandfather, who himself was deeply racist, bragged about it. And so I always knew that there were Black Tomlinsons, and I always wanted to meet them, just curious about what they were like and how they lived their lives. And then as an adult, I began to hear people brag about being fifth-generation Texans, and I watched the conservative politics of our state really kind of deny the impact of history on the present day. And I thought, well, you know, what I need to do is do almost a controlled study. You know, here are two families, same last name, from the same place. The end of the Civil War bankrupted my family, so they were in debt. And clearly, the former slaves had nothing. So let's see what happens to these two families, where the only real difference is the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I follow them in parallel, to really kind of demonstrate that the past still is relevant today.
You had that general outline, and it's a great concept for a book. How much detail did you know going in, or how much anticipation maybe did you have about what you were going to find when you really sort of started applying the journalistic skills and started doing the research? And maybe a follow-up to that question is, what did you find during the course of research and writing the book that you had not anticipated on the front end?
When I set off on this, the only two things I knew were that the plantation was in Falls County, and my father had pointed out that LaDainian Tomlinson was from Falls County, and that could only mean one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one Black Tomlinson family, and it's the one that descended in Falls County, and it's the one that descended from the slave plantation. And that's it. I'd never been to the hill. I didn't even know where it was. I had to go looking for it. And the journey took me through, you know, almost 200 oral interviews, weeks spent going through archives and city, county, and university records. And a couple of things really kind of stood that out to me. One was that, you know, the Blacks who still live on Tomlinson Hill and the Tomlinson family that signs their name every day with the surname of the people who held their ancestors in slavery, this is a very real thing for them. It's not an abstraction. When I introduced myself to people as Chris Tomlinson, if they were the descendants of slaves, they instantly knew who I was and what I represented.
Mm-hmm.
They were far more comfortable with it than I was. I was the awkward one. And second, I discovered that our ancestors knew better. I mean, that was what I was always told, was that, you know, oh, you know, your grandfather, he doesn't know any better. You know, your ancestors, they didn't know better. But when I read their newspapers and I read the books that they read and I realized the context in which they lived, they all knew better. I mean, this was a running debate throughout our history, and they chose profit over morality.
Well, and that's fascinating, because that's always what you hear in any kind of contemporary history class or really discussion of history, is you don't judge the past by the lights of the present, but you discovered that in fact they did know better. I'm going to let that lead into another question. You talk in the book a little bit. I think it's towards the end section. You talk about people asking you if you had any qualms about revealing, you know, this particular dirty laundry, but I don't know if it addressed particularly your family. In terms of surviving family members, how did your family react to the project and your kind of poking into these corners, and how have they reacted to the book since it's come out?
Well, my living relatives, my parents and my aunt, were supportive of the project until they realized that it was going to continue after 1965.
Oh.
and then when they realized that it was going to include their divorces, their struggles with racism, and their points of view, then they became a little more uncomfortable, and they're frankly a little angry right now.
Is that right?
There is a tradition in the South, or all over the world really, where you never speak ill of the dead. And that's exactly what I do with this book. But, you know, I also learned as a foreign correspondent in South Africa and Rwanda that in order to have reconciliation, you have to deal with the past. You have to come to a common understanding of your history. And only then can you build on it and move forward.
In that point, talking about the past, you've previously said that younger Americans need to bear witness to pre-civil rights America and come to terms with some of the actions of our ancestors. It seems you did this by writing this book. I wonder what you would have our fellow Americans do.
I think the first thing any American of any race, of any background, should do is know their family history. The number of people I spoke to said, I don't know where my grandparents grew up. I have no idea what the names of my great-grandparents were. I find that kind of sad and a little disappointing because, you know, who we are is shaped by those people. The opportunities that we have today were provided by the foundation that our ancestors laid. And sometimes, for instance, in my case, the crimes of my ancestors gave me an advantage over African Americans when I was growing up. And that's a tough pill to swallow, but while I don't feel like I need to apologize for what my ancestors did, I do need to be cognizant of the advantages I have today because of them.
Well, one more point I wanted to make is that in the book, it seems that LaDainian Tomlinson experienced a bit of some revelations of his own that were kind of in parallel to yours. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
LaDainian grew up in a single-parent family, really. His parents divorced when he was 9 years old. And his father was in a construction accident, developed a prescription drug addiction that made a relationship difficult for them. And his father was not real proud of being the descendant of sharecroppers. And so he didn't share a lot. So it wasn't until I sat down with LaDainian and I said, you know, I know you're queasy about your family's past, but let me show you that there were some great leaders here. You know, many people think Tomlinson Hill is still called that today because his grandfather was a leader in the black community, and his name was Tomlinson. Milo Tomlinson was one of the first blacks in Falls County to buy and own land of his own. And so that's an example of where I think he was reluctant because he was worried that there would only be bad, and he found that there was good as well.
Okay. If you don't mind, we got a couple of minutes left here. I'd like to switch gears a little bit maybe into the craft. I know this is your first book, and obviously you've got a long career as a foreign correspondent and several different sorts of journalists behind you. How did you find the writing of this book different from the sort of researching and reporting and writing that you were familiar with going in? What did you discover in the process that was new to you?
Well, an African proverb kept ringing in my ears. You know, the way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. It was much more complicated than I could ever have imagined. And while I tried my best to be a detached reporter, you know, I try to report on the living, the dead, the black and the white, you know, the same as if I were reporting in a foreign country. When I sat down to write, it became a much more difficult and kind of painful process of trying to decide what's relevant, what goes in, what goes out, what is my responsibility to the reader. Structure. I mean, the longest thing I'd ever written before this was 28,000 words, and 2,800 words.
I was about to say 28,000 is a long article.
I was going to say it does 2,800 words, and this was 130,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
So just trying to wrangle all that stuff together and structuring it with these parallel narratives in a chronology was a jigsaw puzzle.
It's not a simple story to tackle for your first time out, even with the background you've got. Were there any books, either in the Texas canon or in the national canon, that you used as touchstones or anything as a point of reference to kind of help you through the weeds?
Well, Randolph Campbell's new book, Gone to Texas, is really a masterful piece of history writing. That deals with many different things. I think it's an excellent replacement to Lone Star, which is the Fehrenbach book which I think most detectives have on their shelves, and which is frankly a kind of a neo-Confederate book, and out of date. Dave Blackman's Slavery by Another Name was a contemporary book that that I took some inspiration from. So yeah, it was, if I'd known what it was going to take, I probably would have made this my third, but not my first.
Do you know what the first two would have been?
Well, I've been trying to get someone to publish a book about the soldiers in Iraq, but apparently Iraq books don't sell right now, and particularly ones that are tragic.
I see. Well, let me ask you one more quick question before we let you go. I know you've been doing a lot of readings around the state, doing a lot of radio. Appreciate you making the time for us. What kind, it's interesting when a book goes out into the world and readers get to take some ownership in it. What kind of interesting responses are you finding or getting from audiences as you go around the state to introduce the book?
I'm gratified that so far I've not had anyone accuse me of, it's my face, accuse me of being, you know, a race traitor, I guess. I was very worried about, you know, people coming out and racists coming out and attacking me, and that hasn't happened. I did have a gratifying experience in Dallas a couple of nights ago where a 70-year-old African-American woman came up to me at the end of the reading and said that she'd been waiting her whole life to hear a white person speak the truth about her experience in America. Mm-hmm. And that made the whole thing worthwhile.
I can imagine it did, yeah.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for being on the show and sharing your book with us.
Thank you, guys. And I'm so sorry I can't be there with you. I hope to see y'all both real soon.
Excellent. Yeah, we look forward to it, and check out the new issue of The Observer forthcoming. We've got our own review of Chris's book, positive review, and check out the book.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.